Welcome to the Revolution Church Podcast.
Good morning, everyone. This is Brian Odlin coming at you again for another riveting Revolution Minneapolis talk. I'm sorry we were kind of missing in action the last couple weeks. The first week, it's been about 2 weeks since we've been here. 2 weeks ago was the 4th of July holiday, and I know a lot of people did church and stuff, but we were out of town and kind of wanted to just be with family for a little bit. And then last week, I was sicker than a dog. Really bad head cold and mucus and all that good stuff. So, was not here last week. Now we're back at it, feeling a lot better. So, yeah. So there's that. I want to try to get through my talk a little bit quicker this week. Apologize if it's not as long. I say that, but I usually talk longer than I normally want to. We have some family stuff in town about a half hour south of here, so we want to try to be there as soon as we can. But as people have, or as I've talked about earlier, in the previous couple weeks, we were in the book of James, kind of doing a theme and series on all that good stuff in James. I think what we're taking a 2 week hiatus from that. We're going to come back to it. But I finished a book. Amanda will put it up in the show notes about everything, but I'm going to be talking about Jesus and John Wayne. So, yeah. And Amanda, you might want to switch it to Revolution because it's just me on that page that you're on. Cool? All right. I think she has that. Usually when these things are coming up, it's under our Revolution one right now. There we go. Anyway, technology is great. I have too many tabs on my thing. We're going to talk about Jesus and John Wayne. I'll tell you all what that's about in a second. I do want to say that either next week, most likely probably August 1st, we'll have a special in live guest speaker. My best mate, best friend, whatever you want, wherever you're at in the world, is here from Switzerland, and him and his family are flying up here to the Twin Cities on Friday. So they want to come out and see what all the fuss and hubbub about Revolution is. And I did ask him to come and speak one of those Sundays, so he'll be here talking about something one of those days. So I'm pretty excited to have him talk, to give him the microphone and all that good stuff. So, and I got a beer today instead of pop. I'm spicing it up. You realize once you have a cold and you're taking a lot of medicine, no alcohol or anything tastes good. And now that you're over the cold, you're like, I want a good, cold, refreshing beer in the morning. And I will say this as a big sports fan, especially a football fan, it's appropriate to drink beer as soon as you get up. Because if a game's at noon, you got a pregame, you got to grill out. So if people are like, Brian, it's only 11 o'clock, why are you having a beer? Just think of it as football season, and it's totally okay and totally appropriate. I guess that's just me trying to tell people that's... Yes, and I'm also an adult. See, it's that evangelical toxic theology that's coming out. I just tell you, I don't know. Oh, I did want to make note, shameless plug for the podcast that I run and I host, Sacred Collective. A lot of good episodes have been coming out. Since last time, I have Romer, a.k.a. Ben Siddle. He's a fantastic musician. He's an American, but he lives over in Germany with his family, does a lot of work over there. Really a fantastic musician. Had a great conversation talking to him about church and deconstruction and hell and all that stuff. Then I talked with Keith Giles. really fun dude. He's one of the co-hosts of the hilariously, I would say, irreverent but reverent podcast called The Heretic Happy Hour. Derek Day is one of the other people who is a part of it. So yeah, real cool person that he is. He's written a whole bunch of books called the Jesus Un books, kind of just deconstructing some of our kind of archaic toxic things about Jesus. I interviewed MJ Corcoran about purity culture that just came out. That just came out on Friday. I'm doing a couple more interviews this week. And then I just booked an interview with an author who wrote a book called Murder Bears. Murder Bears Moonshine. And I forget the last of it. We won't put it in the show notes. But the guy, his name's Luke T. Harrington. And he's going back into the Bible stories all about, like, the stuff that most Christians kind of skim over. So a lot of times in the Bible where it talks about, like, prostitution and sex and butts and feces and a lot extreme violent stories, he kind of goes back into the nitty-gritty, and he does it in a very humorous way, but he actually goes back into the Hebrew and is like, this is actually what the translation is, so he knows Greek and Hebrew, and he just makes it. And he's a dad, so he has dad jokes in there, and I'm a dad, and he has dad jokes. So I just thought it was absolutely hilarious, and I reached out to him on Instagram if he wanted to be on, and he's like, hey, I would love to be on your podcast. So that's going to be happening. So I have a lot of cool podcasts, interviews coming up, keeping me busy, keeping Caleb busy as the producer. So, yeah, so that's what's coming down the docket in the next few weeks. If I'm kind of missing an action with podcasts, the last week of July, that's because when Scotty's going to be here next week. And I'm going to be hanging out with my friend all next week, so I'll be not on social media a lot. Anyway, enough of that. So this is Jesus and John Wayne, and kind of the subtitle is The End of Evangelicalism? It's going to be a 2-week talk. Why is this book so important? That's a good question, Brandon. I'm going to tell you why this book is important. This book lays out beautifully how evangelicalism is a stream of Christianity that talks about the idea of God as a cowboy, God as a badass, God as a warrior type of God. It talks a little bit about a warrior type God in the New Testament, but a lot of what this is book's about is a lot of the pop culture, political stuff, but a lot of the scriptures that this author talks about is in the Old Testament. And for people who are watching or listening, I'll do a quick little church historical background. When I talk about evangelicalism, I'm not talking about even within Protestantism, which is all Christianity, minus the Catholic Church and minus like the Orthodox Church. Those are different. But within Protestantism, you have evangelicalism and you have more mainline churches. So more mainline churches are Lutherans, Presbyterians, United Church of Christ, Methodists, Unitarian, Universalists, Quakers, all those. When I talk about evangelicals, I'm talking about Pentecostal movements, I'm talking about Baptists, I'm talking about E-Free, Covenant, you know, all those, what they would call low church. So if you're saying, okay, evangelicalism, Brian, I'm kind of confused. This book is literally written about the low church evangelical movement. So if you're watching and you're a Lutheran or a Methodist or a Presbyterian, this book was not written with you in mind. It was written to a certain segment. Now, the author, if you look at it, the author is actually, she's a Christian herself and highly educated. She has her PhD, and she's a church historian. And she actually teaches at a pretty, I would say, pretty moderate to conservative reform school called Calvin College. Obviously, it's after John Calvin. It was named after. But she is. She doesn't. She's not biased. I don't think at all. Because when you're a historian, you're supposed to give the facts. You're supposed to give the truths, and that's what she's doing. And I'm not going to do this book the service that it does, because I would be here for weeks talking about every little thing that she says that is good. But I'm going to kind of, in an overview, talk about some of her top selling points. And so if you go back in the show notes, in this feed, look up this book. It's highly, highly entertaining, highly informative, and highly just a head scratcher to kind of just show how certain segments of Christianity in our culture has really hijacked parts of Christianity. And the whole name of the book isn't just called Jesus and John Wayne. It's called Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. She's not holding back at how she feels, even in the title of the book. Jesus and John Wayne, obviously how she came up with this title, Jesus, obviously we're Christians. Jesus is the figurehead, the patriarch of our faith, so on and so forth. But why she came up with John Wayne was, let's be honest, if you're like my father, my grandfathers, and probably a lot of men who were born in, you know, late 20s, 30s, 40s, the biggest, baddest cowboy, baddest gunslinger, best fighter was John Wayne. And John Wayne was this epitome of a man's man. And yes, in the book, it kind of goes back into John Wayne's background. He was a womanizer. He was a drunk. He smoked like 2 packs a day. And what people don't know is he was a huge racist. And he was homophobic, all that stuff. But a lot of men, Christian men particularly, loved John Wayne as this kind of rugged, individualistic, you know, no-nonsense badass. He was this cowboy. I mean, there's parts of the country still to this day where a lot of men have that mentality. You go to certain parts of South Dakota or like Wyoming and Montana, and you're going to see a guy literally looking like John Wayne with a cowboy boots and chaps and gun or two on their hip and whatever. So she's kind of bringing up this mythos of how so many Christians look at Jesus in a way of like a John Wayne. Like when we talk about Jesus and we're like, we serve this God named Jesus, a lot of us have this mentality that Jesus is this, you know, kind of like this cowboy, you know, kicking ass and taking names in the Wild West, which the Wild West, I guess, in this case is the whole world. And so like the first chapter or two, she more or less kind of just goes through the background of just John Wayne and who John Wayne is, why we love him in this culture, and why he's kind of the figurehead, fatherhead of this rugged American individualism, and how so many people just fall into that. Like, this is what a man is. This is how a man is supposed to be acting. This is how a Christian man is supposed to act. Even though you watch any of John Wayne's movies, whether they're Westerns or action movies, people need to realize John Wayne is, he's a real person, but his characters he plays is just that. They're characters in a movie. Then it goes, I mean, this is a 300-page book, so I am not going to be able to, like I said, give it all the credit that it is, but just hitting some of these points. And next week is going to be a little bit more in depth than this one. This talk is more of a brief overview of the first couple chapters and kind of laying the groundwork of what it's going to be next week. But as I was telling a couple of people here in the audience who, before we started recording, really how the evangelical movement kind of hijacked this mentality of Christianity went all the way, it kind of started out back in like the 20s, the 1920s, with the women's suffrage movement, where women were wanting more power. They were wanting voting rights. They were wanting, you know, equal labor laws when it comes to jobs. They were not wanting to just be housewives. They wanted to be working just like the men. And you could kind of see some of these gender roles that were trying to be ebbed away kind of from our consciousness. Because when we, as Americans, we, a lot of Americans don't like to just push the envelope. A lot of Americans, men and women, we just like to say, oh, yeah, there's problematic with this, or this is problematic. But what do? It's just me. I don't know. I can't do anything. And so people don't fight back for it. Like these, a lot of women, even in the suffrage movement, probably, you know, it wasn't just a certain women that did it. It was thousands, if not millions of women. But kind of going back to that, she kind of briefly talks how a little bit that is, but she said how it really started to get big with this kind of idea about Jesus, and well, about Jesus and this John Wayne, was in like the 60s and 70s, where the 60s was the hippie movement, was this huge in our society, in the American society, this huge revolt of what quote-unquote morality is. Like, the church is telling me I shouldn't do this. The church is telling me I shouldn't do that. My parents are telling me I shouldn't do this or that. And you saw this revolt of, you know, the hippie movement of free love, you know, free sex. And it wasn't even like free sex in the point of we're going to do anything and everything. It was more of like sex wasn't just in the confines of marriage anymore. You had... I know Stonewall was later, but you actually had out and open and in the public of people being queer and being able to come out and say, I'm gay or lesbian or bisexual. And before that, before this hippie movement, you just really didn't see that as often. It was very quiet. Like I had a great uncle who was gay and could never talk about it. Got married to a woman, had family. And no one ever talked about it because it was the 40s and it was the 50s. You couldn't be queer. You couldn't be gay. I mean, you could literally be kicked out of your community. You could have gotten fired from your job. Heavens, you could never even be in church if you were you're queer. So you see this rise of the countercultural movement was in a whole. You see that. And then it also picks up even more in the 70s within... drugs becoming more popular and more, I guess, just not legal, but more accepted. But then within this 60s and 70s, the author, Kristen Dumais, she kind of brings up that's where you saw a lot of, quote-unquote, evangelical Christians start realizing and looking at the culture kind of almost as a quasi-sociologist, of like, we're losing this culture war. We're losing this, we're losing church. We're losing our foothold in relevancy within Christianity in America. And you see in the 70s, and she lays out beautifully, she talks about, she goes really in depth about James Dobson, but the start of Focus on the Family. She goes in and talks about Pat Robertson, which I'll talk more about that next week, the in-depthness of it. And there's actually quite a number of women who got involved too. A lot of people just think, oh, like it was all white evangelical males who were kind of pushing this ideology, this philosophy of kind of this new morality within the evangelical church. And it was a lot of women too. And one woman she brings up was Phyllis Schlafly, if I'm not right, but I think that's her name. And how Phyllis Schlafly, she just wrote like a pretty much the primer, we wouldn't look at it now as that, but the primer on purity culture and how women needed to be submissive. And taking these clobber passages that we see, they're totally out of context. And I will tell you, most of these people were not educated. Education is really huge, especially when you're going to be writing books, when you're going to be speaking at conferences and churches all over the country. You got to learn how to understand the text. You got to understand what this meant in the Bible. Is it supposed to be taken as literal? Is it supposed to be taken as a metaphor or whatever? And so she wrote a number of books on, in essence, women's roles, their gender roles, the submissiveness. And she would never say that men need to be submissive to their wives. It was always like women need to be submissive to their husband. The husbands are the ones, you know, leading the home. The husbands are the ones leading the country, the church, so on and so forth. And she had, I want to say in there, she had... she wrote this book, and within like a year, it went from selling like 10,000 copies to selling like 3 million copies within a year. It's just crazy. And out of that, she was one of many who kind of got this moral majority started. The moral majority started more in the 70s, but it did the frame, it did, you could see in the 60s and 70s, in that 20-year time frame in that generation, you saw people losing power. You saw the church, the evangelical movement, which is relatively new as a movement itself, even in the 50s and 60s. You saw they knew they were losing power. They knew that they were losing their foothold. And so they kind of did this internal audit at in different levels. There's like the National Association of Evangelicals at that time, and all these other kind of smaller fringe wing groups that really were like, we are losing this, you know, foothold on this American society. What do we do? And so they all got together, and she does lays it out beautifully at how it's a power struggle, it's a power dynamic, it's control. And there, and she actually found like sealed documents that certain politicians, certain pastors had, certain evangelical movements had, that literally were like, we need to do this. Like, this is the battle plan. This is the blueprint of how we're taking our society back. And the main thing what they did, and we should probably not be at all surprised at this, is they said, we need to get into the politics. We need to get in out of the church, and we need to spend the money and literally get in bed with politicians. And it's very, very sad that that happened. But one of the main people that they got in bed with was Ronald Reagan. And I was right in his presidency is when yours truly was born. But a lot of people, especially a lot of evangelical Christians, and you'd be surprised how many people love Ronald Reagan. They think he was a badass. Oh, and she makes a very good comparison at how Ronald Reagan in a lot of ways was like a John Wayne. He was an actor. He was in politics, very misogynistic, very, what's the word? Very like cowboy-esque. I mean, if you look at some of Ronald Reagan's earlier movies, and then you realize, like, hey, not only did this guy become the governor of California, but then he became our president. Like, that's crazy. And then you kind of see some parallels of him and Donald Trump. Donald Trump wasn't an actor in movies, but he was definitely in media with, you know, all of the stuff that he does with his Trump empire. And so... But then she kind of goes, talks back about some of these other other presidents we've had back then, like LBJ, Nixon, and you had, and she actually brings up, if we are looking at Christian character, if we're looking at the character that we want someone to have as a president, well, Jimmy Carter was great because he was a peanut farmer down south. He was pretty conservative in a lot of rights. But the reason evangelicals didn't like him is because he had that social aspect. He was social. He was like, and he would even say in the White House, that, like, hey, our job, like, Jesus wants us to be in the communities taking care of the widow, the orphan, and the poor. And look at even now, Jimmy Carter's, I don't know, like mid-90s. The guy's older than dirt, and he's still doing Habitat for Humanity, building houses, donating money to charities and organizations. And the evangelical church turned their back on him, and they were like, yeah, he's Democrat, he's liberal, he's hippy-dippy, whatever. But, and then you see the Republicans getting behind, you know, Reagan and all these other conservative white people in these political races. And she lays out beautifully how evangelicals purposely align themselves with, you know, how white evangelical pastors align themselves with politicians and said, this is how we're going to change the narrative. And when I was reading it, what bothered me so much is I was like, when we look at scripture, when we look at Jesus, who did Jesus have the most issue with? He had the most issue with the religious people of his day, aka Pharisees, and he had the next biggest issue with the religious, or with the politicians of the day, Rome, others. And it's so striking to me when I was reading it, and I obviously she was bringing this up, and was like, but why is there so many Christians in this evangelical movement? That's exactly who they went to bed with, in essence. There was this religious group, they went to the politicians and were like, let's change this. But they were trying to do it because they were like, Jesus, 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 we're going back to scripture. And they're looking at these clobber passages about sex and sexuality. And in there, in here, you can see there's this stream of homophobicness, not by the author, but by what she's talking to all these men and women who are making all these rules and laws, changing the kind of like the narrative of what evangelicalism is. All of them were super homophobic. And you can tell why, even now in America, in the evangelical movement, why still abortion and gay rights and gay marriage is still a hot button topic to people. And I've said to family and friends who are very conservative and evangelical, I'm like, why do you guys still preach on that? Why do you harp on that? I'm like, abortion rights, women's rights aren't going, like, you guys lost that war. And I said, with gay rights, you lost that war. Like, nationally, queer people in this country have been able to be married almost 10 years now. And in other parts of the world, it's been decades that they can do it. But when you read this book, you realize they know they lost part of a war. They look at it more as this, we lost the first part of this long, long war. But if we get our men and women in, if we get the men and women in we want, then they're going to come in, they're going to fill the Supreme Court, they're going to fill these other people in politics, and we're going to change their narrative and we're going to bring it back. But when I was reading it, it just kept coming up where I was like, this has nothing to do about Jesus. It says, this has nothing, not one iota, to do about Jesus and his teachings. It has everything to do with what? Control, power. And I was reading, and she doesn't necessarily say all these words, but any thinking person can read this and be like, that's exactly why they're doing this. And I don't know if people know out there who's listening, this actually was a documentary that came out on Netflix, I want to say a year or two ago, but she brings light to it. There's actually a very powerful organization in Washington, D.C., and I think it's called Friends, or the Friendship, or the Fellowship. And it literally is powerful. And I don't know if there's women in there. I think it's just men. But it's this quote-unquote private group, but people obviously know about it, of Christians, pastors, presidents of universities, president of seminaries, highly powerful people, even people in CIA, FBI, people who are running this country. And pastors, and their job is to come up with all this stuff and bring it to the president, bring it to branches of the military, bring it to the Supreme Court justices. They're in a way, what would you call them? lobbyists. They're lobbyists, and it's not lobbying to be like, hey, let's deregulate criminal stuff for drugs. It's like, hey, let's make gay marriage illegal. Why? Well, because we want to, because we're losing people in our churches. We're losing people into our denomination. We can't control the narrative anymore. We lost the narrative, and so we're now going to try to do all this politically. And like the first, I want to say the good first half, maybe 60% of this book is literally her going back from John Wayne as a starting point up to kind of like the early 90s of just saying, folks, this is why evangelicalism is the way it is. And she doesn't sing praises to Protestants, but Protestants, mainline Protestants, like more liberal progressive churches, she kind of chides them a little bit of like, you can't even talk about Jesus in a lot of churches anymore. You can't even talk about missing the mark, aka sin. You can't even talk about, hey, do you have a relationship with God? It's more of like, hey, cool, we're all like-minded, we're predominantly white, but hey, guess what? Like, Jesus was socially driven. Like, Jesus was a socialist, or he was a Democrat. So she kind of chides them a little bit, but it's like, at least they will come out and say that. White progressives will be like, yes, we're unabashedly liberal. Yes, we're this, 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 and this. And that's fine. You know, she's not pointing that as a bad thing, and neither am I. But what she's going with the Jesus and John Wayne is she was like, you can see in our culture by just going back historically, and any sociologist, any historian who studies like American history or even church history can see where the church diverged and went straight into politics. And it's kind of weird that there maybe was a time in our American history where, guess what, separation of church and state, that's a thing. That's in our Constitution if we forget about how the church should be separate and do this thing, and the government should be here and doing that, and they shouldn't intermingle. But we live in a culture now where the church has every ounce of itself in the church, even progressive Christianity, and especially evangelical Christianity. And one part I would be remiss to say if I didn't bring it up, but Billy Graham. I grew up thinking Billy Graham was this kick-ass, awesome, badass Christian in a way like John Wayne. And has he done good things for the faith? Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to lie. I mean, Northwestern College or University up here in St. Paul was founded by him. I've had a lot of friends who went there who are very smart, respectable people in faith. But he was the first kind of one of the big culprits who kind of was like, guess what? We're losing this power. We're losing this dynamic. We're losing the narrative. I'm going to start talking to some politicians. And he did it at a very micro level. But you could see, like, earlier on, like, in the 40s and stuff, when he started doing his, you know, big tent revivals and stuff, that it was more literally about Jesus. What can Jesus do to change your life, to make you a better person? And then probably from, I don't know, it was like from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, he was this militant, like, everything going into politics. And then you can see later on in his life, and I remember seeing some of his talks before, you know, in the last decade of his life, is he started singing a different tune. He never came out in full support of queer people, but he was kind of always like, hey, that's not our, you know, let's not talk about that. There's more important things. But she talks about in here of, like, how he was this first person within evangelicalism, one of the first people who really kind of started this trajectory towards how the evangelical church needs to get inside politics to change it. And sad to say, but in our society, whoever gives the most money, whoever cries the loudest, whoever is, you know, the talking heads of the time, and they keep pushing and pushing and pushing, they're the ones that get heard. And the evangelical machine, as I'm going to call it, is spending a lot of their money, a lot of their resources, a lot of their free time and ministries on trying to bring back this narrative, of trying to bring back the control. And I've said to a lot of people, I have issues with the church itself because it's less about a relationship with God. It's less about trying to take these philosophies and these ideologies about Jesus and which he wants us to live and treat others. It's less about community and it's more about control. How can I, as a Baptist pastor, as a Pentecostal pastor, bring Curtis or Vicky or Amanda into my circle and into my church and into my denomination in order for them to give me money or my denomination money in order for me to get my political agendas or this politician in? So in at the end of it, then we can overturn some of these what they call oppressive rules or oppressive things. And I always find it so funny is how when people say, oh, when our country was founded, it was founded, you know, for freedom of all this stuff and blah, 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 freedom of religion, freedom of this. And I would actually say if you look back at early, the inception of American, of our country and all that, most of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence were not even Christians. And if I'm not mistaken, if anybody is a history person here, I love history, but I'm not a historian. But the only requirement that you had to do in order to be in politics, like a politician, or to sign the Declaration was to believe that there was some sort of higher power. It did not say God. It did not say Jesus. It had to be, yeah, I believe there's a higher power bigger than me. Then that in a lot, and I actually did a paper in college where I was like, most of the founding fathers were deists. And deism is just the understanding of there is a higher power. It could be God. It could be Zeus for crying out loud. There's something bigger than me that created this world, created the universe, and that's it. I mean, you could even believe that Satan is your higher power because it's a deity and it's a being higher than you. That was it. That was it. And a lot of people who signed the Declaration of Independence were part of the Hellfire Club, which people don't realize. The Hellfire Club started in Britain because most of our founding fathers were formerly British. Hellfire Club was a club where they were really wealthy white men who had a lot of sex with a lot of prostitutes when they were married. Got drunk, did a lot of drugs. So it's kind of funny, all these things that we as evangelicals say, that's bad, that's wrong. Well, our founding fathers were the people who did all these things. And then they say at the pulpit in these churches or in these big organizations, look, the founding fathers did this. They were these great men and women or great men of God. It's like, were they? Were they? And I'm not saying people can't have momentary lapses of good judgment, but when you just go back and just study our own history of how our country was founded, you realize, yeah, it was always about power. It was always about control. And when you get in this book even more, you're going to see how Billy Graham lusted for power. You're going to see how James Dobson lusted for power. You're going to see how, I mean, and they bring up she brings up a little bit about the televangelists in the 80s. You see, I hate to say it, the Bakers, you see Jimmy Swaggart, you see Falwells, they all started out doing good things, but they started realizing, I can change this culture, not just the church, I can change this culture by getting in bed with politicians, by lobbying for super evangelical, super conservative things. But at the same time, you see progressive mainliners being like, oh, these are a bunch of crazy evangelical people over here. Nothing's going to happen. Well, and guess what? What did we see in the culmination in 2016? What did we see? I think a big part of society was like I remember when Trump put in his candidacy for president. And mind you, he put his name in the ring for 2012. And I mean, I don't even think he made it to like any primaries, and then he dropped out. And then people, you know, he ran again. And I think everyone, I remember when he put his candidacy in, and he was up against Jeb Bush, the Bush powerhouse. He was up against Marco Rubio, Mitt Romney, a lot of people who ran for president before or who are from presidential families. And I was like, there's no way, no way, no way that Trump could ever in a million years win. And then on election night, I mean, he destroyed Hillary, just absolutely destroyed Hillary. But she goes so beautifully in this book of this is why Trump won. Trump won because you had all these evangelicals being told how terrible and disgusting and nasty their country is, how you as a white man or woman are being lost in this culture. If you're a straight person, you're being lost in this culture because everything's about, you know, being queer and having sex and doing whatever. And it all goes back into like the 60s and 70s, like the free love and people wanting all these, what I would say is a normal basic rights, you know. Women should have the same rights as men. They should be paid equally. You should be able to marry whoever you want as an adult. All these things that are normal human things that most societies have. And the evangelical church since the 60s or 70s, and I can remember growing up in the AG church, it was always, we need to go out to the world because the world is sick, it's dying, it's depraved, it's horrible, it's evil. And I remember when I left evangelicalism, I had this mentality of like, I'm like, every time I walk outside, I'm just walking into this big bad world of sin, and there's nothing in here that's redeemable, beautiful, whatever. And now, not really labeling myself anything but a believer in the teachings of Jesus, I can go outside and be like, man, people are wonderful. People are beautiful. Not saying that shit doesn't happen, but I can actually go outside and be like, you know, it's a hot, humid day, but man, I hear the birds chirping. I see the squirrels playing. I see, you know, people hugging each other finally after the pandemic. People are actually, you know, going out in public and you know, having bonfires or grills, and, you know, sporting events are happening. But growing up in the evangelical church, it was always like, you're a wretch. You're a terrible person. You're this horrible, irredeemable person without the love and compassion of Jesus Christ. And we were at a funeral yesterday, a family funeral, and how many of us grew up with Amazing Grace? It's such an old, so that song is almost as old as our country, I feel like. And there is a song in there that I can't, there's a saying in there, I cannot sing it. And it's like, what a wretch I am, or something like that. And I can't sing it because I'm like, I'm not a wretch. Yes, do I miss the mark as a person? Sometimes, absolutely. But that song is like self-deprecating. It's literally making you as the singer of it saying, I am a terrible, nasty person, and the only value that I have is if my life is found in Jesus. And a lot of people are going to be like, well, yeah, Brian, like you're only, you know, you're going to go to hell without the love of Jesus. But it's like, how much trauma has that caused people throughout millennia? When they're like, you know what, you're only a lovable person because of Jesus. There's nothing else that's redeemable about you. You're not a good person, you're not this. You're terrible because you're a wretch, and the only way that you become a good person is with Jesus. And like I said, I want to wrap this up sooner because we have a family thing, but my frustration with evangelicalism is not people's love for Jesus. It's not people's wanting to be in community with like-minded people, because all people want to do that. My issue is with any religious branch within Christianity, any stream, is once they get away from the teachings and the message of Jesus and they start getting into politics. And I'm not saying you can't be a Christian or just a person and not have political aspirations or vote for your person. I think voting is an amazing thing we do in our country, especially in our democracy, that everyone over the age of 18 has the right to vote federally for our national leaders and locally. I think it's a great thing. And she even brings up in here, it's not, voting isn't what's at issue here. What's at issue is when segments of a religion of Christianity, is when the segments of Christianity will literally say, we lost control. We don't control the narrative anymore. It's that cold still hanging on. It's when we've lost the control. We've lost the power. And so now we need to spend all of this money, all of these resources. We need to get musicians. We need to get publishing houses. We need to get all of these things on our side so we can change the narrative. And that is what I think she writes and finds so problematic is, we want to know why Trump won the election. This wasn't something that was put into work 3 years before his presidency. It's been going on for decades and decades. And you heard, Trump saying, oh, I want to drain the swamp. And you talk to a lot of white men and women, and even people of other races who are evangelicals, that why they liked when he said draining the swamp is because they were like, all the people that are in there in the presidential race in the White House are not people who value our values. More or less what they were saying, they weren't people that agreed with them. They were people who were like, I don't want a president who says it's okay to be queer. I don't want a president who says that my neighbor down the street can have sex and then have an abortion. Like, I don't want a president who says that can happen. And so that's why they're wanting to, like, drain the swamp. And as I said, we're going back to our inception of our country. That's why people came over to this country, was so religious people, so the Church of England would not tell people how they needed to worship. But yet now there's a big segment of Christianity that's exactly what they're trying to tell us to do, is how to believe, how to not just worship, but how to be a good political person. And the other thing in there is, she doesn't bring it up a lot compared to other things, but there's the Christian nationalism, the Christian supremacy that we see, and it's all kind of up in there. And I will say this, this is Brian's hot take. I do not understand, and this will say this, I will say this to, I've seen a lot of progressive churches still have this, predominantly in evangelical churches, but why in the heck do you have an American flag up on your pulpit or up in your there, and then the Christian flag? I understand if you want to have like the flag outside, like in your parking lot, whatever, that's fine. But first of all, why do Christians need a flag? I don't get it. But then having someone up there, having a worship band, having your pastors up on stage, so on and so forth. Then having the, and it's funny because I've actually heard in progressive churches people say, oh, well, Christian nationalism is wrong and, the supremacy. And then I'm thinking, well, look what you have on your stage, though. You're having a Christian flag and an American flag. And I'm like, and then I look back and I try to hearken back and like the stories of Jesus, and especially when he was, in his trial and stuff, where Jesus was literally mocking Rome, mocking, like, okay, yeah, you're Rome, cool, great. Well, mocking governmental stuff, because Jesus is like, my ideology, my thinking, my this of Christianity is not about where you live. It's not about your country. It's not about Rome. It's not about all that, because Jesus blurs the lines. It doesn't matter if you're male or female. It doesn't matter if you're Jew or Gentile. Doesn't matter if you're slave nor free. He's literally saying whatever society in the world is telling you, like why you can and cannot do something, I'm coming to tell you, like, that's all. I've destroyed that. I've destroyed it. But especially going back to the book, we, especially as Americans, we haven't gotten that. We haven't understood. I don't know. We just haven't. Certain people, certain aspects and streams of Christianity maybe has been better, but by and large the evangelical church, they didn't get it. And this is a sermon series this week and next week. Yeah, and it's going to be tisk-tisk on the evangelical church. And I think it needs to come out more. I will rail on mainland Protestants till I turn red in the face. But people need to realize, like, this ex-evangelical movement, it's a movement. It's a movement. And people are like, and even people like Dobson, either like in Falwell's, you know, I know Jerry Falwell Jr. kind of has had his fall from grace. But a lot of these organizations and super evangelical schools, they're like, oh, the ex-evangelical movement or the deconstruction movement, they're this, this, and this. So they're actually giving precedence to it. They know it's a thing. They know it's happening. And they're like, oh, it's just these people weren't really Christians or whatever. No, I think it's the younger generation that's coming out and saying, enough's enough. Like, we don't have an issue. And you talk to a lot of people who are ex-evangelicals, and they're like, oh, I'm deconstructing my evangelicalism. But nowhere in their bios on Instagram or Facebook is they're like, I hate Jesus. Jesus is an asshole, and he's a bigot, and blah, blah, blah. It's the church is what's the problem. The church is what's causing me hurt. The church is what's causing me harm. And I think is like, and I had a friend that I was talking with, and he said this phrase, and it was great because we've talked about reformations, and we know that every 500 years or so, using Phyllis Tickle's language, the church cleans out its closet. This is stuff we're going to keep. This is stuff we're not going to keep. And you look at historically, we're pretty accurate as that in our culture and in the world. But I think what you're seeing now is this microcosm of a de-reformation. We're de-reforming in a way because we're living in a culture now where the younger generations are like, I can still believe in the teachings and messages of Jesus without going to church. I can have church on TV, you know, looking into a revolution. I can go out to the bar with my buddies and have a really deep conversation about God. Or about life. I can go to Pride, which is happening right now, not say anything about Jesus, but just be there as an ally and be there as a friendly person. That's church. That's Christianity. And you're seeing this de-reformation in a way of a lot of people don't hate Jesus. They just hate the bullshit that connects with it. And when if somebody asks me like, well, Brian, what's your religious views? I always tell people I love Jesus and I love the teachings and message of Jesus. And that's what I try to mimic. And they're like, what else? And I'm like, that's all that's important to me. You know, and people are like, oh, well, you know, what do you think about this? I'm like, I can give you my own personal views and opinions. But at the end of the day, I'm like, I'm just trying to tell people about the teachings and message of Jesus. And we try to live that out. I'm going to stop there for today. Next week, I'm going to finish off and I'm going to kind of talk about how bring it more into the current context when we're going to talk about what she talks about in here is how toxic masculinity, it started out as we're losing control over these social issues, and now what's happened within the evangelical movement since like the early 90s is this rise of huge toxic masculinity within the church. And we're going to talk about promise keepers. We're going to talk about people like Mark Driscoll, some of these other megachurch pastors, and showing how they hearkened back to people like Pat Robertson, like James Dobson, even though they'll say they're not anything like them, but you'll see how their toxic masculinity and their white supremacy and their church supremacy has kind of infiltrated, not kind of, but has very much infiltrated American evangelicalism. And then you can obviously see why Trump is elected and how he actually did come out, I think, this weekend or last weekend and said he's running again in 2024. Anyway, that's all I have. Anybody have? I don't think we have any questions streaming. Does anybody have any questions they want to say? We can always talk afterwards, too. If not, then sorry if I was a little nasally getting over this cold. But everyone have a good week. We'll have some of my friends that are coming from overseas. And stay safe, be nice, and be kind to everyone. Have a good day. Bye.